With over 50% of Americans using dietary supplements and an estimated $30 billion a year spent on pills, supplements, special foods, and weight loss programs, media and economic trends in the U.S. reflect a growing interest in dietary modification in the pursuit of health and improved appearance. This remains an important consideration for the dermatologist. In our next dialogue, Dr. Christine DeWitt and Dr. Linda Calls discuss current thoughts regarding diet, inflammation, and the skin.
We're going to talk about diet, inflammation, and the skin. We hear a lot about diseases being more prevalent in cultures with a typical Western diet, such as type 2 diabetes and heart disease. And I think most dermatologists are routinely asked by our patients if there's any vitamins or dietary changes they can make to improve their acne or psoriasis or dermatitis. There seems to be a lot of motivation for patients to attribute or try to control their skin disease through diet, but not a lot of concrete recommendations that we offer. So what are some of the emerging theories between diet and disease?
Well, I think really what's happening is a growing movement that is originating with patients. And we're seeing it as physicians in that more and more patients are asking us about what are our recommendations for dietary changes. But even in the statistics, half of the U.S. population take some sort of over-the-counter non-prescription supplement by their own choosing. It's a multi-billion dollar specialty, so there's a growing demand, but what they're really wanting to know is what do we as physicians recommend? And I think what's happening is through circumstantial evidence, we're able to piece together theories. And right now, there's really not a lot of data to support some of these paradigm shifts. And we really have to think about it as a paradigm shift. And through studies that are done in the literature, you can take bits and pieces to use that as circumstantial evidence. One example that I provide to patients is the United States has a growing lifetime risk of autoimmune diseases. And the statistics are 1 in 12 women and 1 in 20 men will have a lifetime risk of developing some autoimmune disease. And what's probably happening is patients are born with a genetic hit, and through an environmental trigger, they're unmasking their disease. And so when you have the environmental trigger that happens, you probably can't unflip the switch. So I tell patients, you know, while we may be recommending some dietary changes, you might not be able to unflip that switch, but you can certainly make some recommendations that either have your disease process less severe or maybe even decrease or lower doses of medications.
So sort of through diet, you could maybe mitigate their disease, not necessarily cure it, but help to control it.
Right. And I think in the United States, we've got some competing interests. We have a lot of special interest groups, a lot of lobbying groups that are from very big industries that get a hold of a lot of media, as well as sort of vested financial interested groups to promote specific fad diets. And so the consumer is flooded with quick fixes and gimmicks and fads. And so you can even see through the USDA of what the US is recommending for diet, every decade they seem to come out with a different set of recommendations. And when I was looking at everything through time, I feel like there's also been this public enemy number one, and the government sort of latches onto that and vilifies it, and then people almost perseverate to an nth degree on trying to fix that problem. And so as an example, high cholesterol was a problem that at a scientific meeting, I think there was only about 10 individuals at this meeting making formal recommendations on cholesterol. And they said, let's just eliminate cholesterol and cholesterol levels should go down. But we know as scientists and physicians that you can't just control a body's level of something by eliminating a dietary input. It's much more complex than that.
Interesting. So really not based on science.
Right.
But
right.
Based on industry pressure.
The same drivers of the low-fat craze of the 1990s. All these products were developed that were high in sugar, very processed, but they certainly didn't have fat. And so what happened is our consumers and patients consumed it and got more fat. And so now I think we're onto something with our patients when we're recommending unprocessed foods. And that's a loaded phrase because that can mean a lot of different things. I personally recommend more of a whole food diet. And that means minimization or complete elimination of grains, legumes, and dairy. And this is sort of counter to what a lot of providers are telling their patients, where they're recommending increasing their whole grains and increasing dairy consumption because of vitamin D and calcium concerns.
So what are some of the inflammatory players or evidence that shows this is a diet that's going to be helpful?
Right. So if you think about what happens when you eat something, you are making a byproduct through a chemical reaction. And all chemistry has a net acid or base byproduct. And so foods that produce acid in the body are typically things like meat, dairy, and grains. Things that are a net alkaline are typically your fruits and your vegetables. This, the fruits and the vegetables, are the predominant sources of where we're deriving our body's alkaline stores, our bone minerals. Bone minerals are the great pH buffer. So if the body is acidic, the bone is the source for calcium, magnesium products that are able to buffer the acidic environment. And so probably what's happening in osteoporosis is that through a Western diet or a very acidic diet, we are using our bones to bathe in that acid and neutralize that reaction. And so osteoporosis is on the rise. And you just don't see that in other countries like you do with the United States.
That's fascinating, really. What other key players are
right.
involved?
Right, so gluten is a really hot topic right now. And there's a big debate going on with respect to gluten sensitivities. And there's a growing population that is gluten insensitive. So they're not forming the autoantibodies, but they certainly have disease processes that improve once you eliminate gluten from the diet. What's probably happening is that those individuals who have the antibodies are the tip of the iceberg. So their immune dyscrasia is so to the degree that they've actually gone on to form an antibody targeting gliadin of the gluten molecule. They've also discovered through basic science that in the gut there is a chemokine receptor that binds gliadin. Through this receptor binding, you upregulate a new protein called zonulin. Zonulin is named after the cholera toxin. So cholera, as we know, increases leaky gut. And the cholera toxin is called zonula occludens toxin. So when gliadin binds to this chemokine receptor, zonulin is upregulated, and you actually have cytoskeletal reorganization, and the gut becomes leaky. In addition to that, you're changing the gut microbiome milieu. So when you're looking at the immune response, you're upregulating TNF-alpha. Sounds familiar with our psoriasis patients. You are lowering the T regulatory cells, which is important. So IL-10 secretors, you need these T regs in place to dial down hyperimmune processes such as lupus, insulin-dependent diabetes, celiac, and probably even alopecia areata, as we're starting to learn through their genome-wide studies.
So eating gluten, even if you don't have antibodies against gluten, will somehow expose your GI tract to inflammatory mediators that can worsen these autoimmune diseases.
Right, and I actually think of the gut as skin on the inside. And so probably if you're manifesting inflammatory dermatoses, whether it's acne, psoriasis, eczema, lupus, that's probably a marker of what's going on internally. And a lot of it probably has origins in the gut. And so through our evaluations of the gut microbiome, and we're working on figuring out the skin microbiome, there's going to be probably a lot that ties back to that. And if you think about it, some of the concerns with isotretinoin and inflammatory bowel disease in our acne patients, well, there's two concerns there in my mind. One, acne might be a part of a greater process in those individuals with inflammatory bowel disease, so they might be at risk anyway for having developed that if they have such severe acne that needed Accutane or isotretinoin. But number two, there was a subsequent study looking at the use of tetracyclines. That had more of a correlation with inflammatory bowel disease that was independent of the use of isotretinoin. So it wouldn't surprise me if you actually had a changing of the gut flora that then therefore set up the right environmental trigger for those with inflammatory bowel disease.
So are probiotics helpful?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're starting to see some studies emerge with the benefit of concurrent use of probiotic with oral antibiotics, at least in skin disease. They've shown that there's synergistic behavior with response to inflammatory lesion count, for example, in acne. So there was a poster presentation at the Academy meeting where a small group, and similar to a lot of dietary studies, there are always small groups. There were three groups, one with minocycline only, one with probiotic, and then one with a combined therapeutic intervention. The combined group had better outcomes in terms of lower lesion count, but more importantly, lower inflammatory counts. You're also not going to be getting for women, the risk of vaginal yeast infections, and patients tend to tolerate those tetracyclines with the GI upset much, much better.
You put your patients on probiotics?
Always.
Mm-hmm. And what kind do you use?
That's the other problem. When you go to any health food store, there's no universal brand. There's a couple of brands out there, but right now there's no standardization of probiotics. And so what I usually tell patients is when you go to the pharmacy or the grocery store, flip the box over, look at the active ingredients, and go for one that has a high bacterial count. But mostly Lactobacillus, Bifidobacterium are going to be your predominant species.
And what's a high bacterial count? What number would you be looking for?
Well, again, it depends. It's on the magnitude of billions. And usually what you're doing is you're cross-comparing one brand to the next. And again, this is all not regulated. This is all driven from the producers of the supplements.
Now, I've also heard about omega-3 fatty acids and psoriasis.
So omega-3, this goes, again, back to inflammation. And getting back to the basic science a little bit, omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids are different sides of the same coin. You need both, but the ratio is probably what's the most important part. Omega-3, you can consider as anti-inflammatory when you look at the downstream products from leukotrienes and prostaglandins. Omega-6 is the parent molecule of what you would need through arachidonic acid to produce pro-inflammatory leukotrienes and prostaglandins. And in fact, omega-6, through the conversion of arachidonic acid, is what's targeted when you're using aspirin, non-steroidals, and corticosteroids. The typical American diet has a ratio of about 20 to 30 to 1 of omega-6 to omega-3. Our ancient ancestors, who our genome is probably better designed to tolerate, the optimal ratio is probably closer to 4 to 5 to 1. And that is because our diets are high in omega-6, low in omega-3. Most Americans don't consume fish. Most Americans have a pro-inflammatory diet, and so consequently, omega-3 in many subspecialties are showing these wonderful benefits: ophthalmology, cardiology, renal, GI, dermatology even. We're seeing patients that are put on omega-3 fatty acids, and they're getting improvement, but the problem is when you do these trials, you've got to standardize the dose, and because of that, the pharmaceutical company developed a prescription omega-3 fatty acid. It's esterified. The brand name is Loveza. The problem with this medication, it's approved to treat familial hypertriglyceridemia. The problem is one of the side effects is that it increases LDL. When we use this medication in autoimmune patients, for example, lupus, they do have an elevation in their LDL. I'm probably of the mind that we shouldn't be using the esterified versions. You're probably needing to co-administer with 6. Even though it is pro-inflammatory, there's probably something that happens with the chemistry that you need the other to balance the other out. And I don't think that you would have those side effects if you just use the natural version of it, but we've got to be better at producing reputable, reproducible brands.
So is the natural occurring version of it available in food?
Mm-hmm.
What I know fish, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. what other foods? Flaxseed.
So, actually, I'm glad you brought that up. Flaxseed, and my poor vegetarians, they do have a hard time. I do think that vegetarians are a special case. Omega 6 and 3 is found in flaxseed. The problem is when you convert omega 6 in flaxseed to 3, you do get a lot more omega 6 than you should be getting. And so a better way of introducing flax is, for example, in eggs. So to have the chicken consume the flaxseed, do the metabolic reaction in their body, and then they produce an egg that has a high omega-3 fatty acid in the egg. Interestingly, if you have a grass-fed, open-range meat from a lamb or a cow that's raised in a way that is closer to how they were built, they actually have just as much omega-3 fatty acid as salmon does. But our corporate corn-fed, antibiotic-fed cows, chickens, lamb, they're not producing those same levels. They have much, much higher levels of omega-6 versus 3.
Can you explain more the Paleolithic diet? Is this nuts and berries?
Sure, sure. So there's a lot of terminology used to describe the same basic diet. And the theory is that through our ancient hunter-gatherer ancestors, where we spent most of our genetic time developing our genome, we really didn't have a lot of dietary changes. We pretty much ate the same thing. We hunted and we gathered, and we did that for hundreds of thousands of years. Recently, we've had the agricultural revolution. We've had processed foods. We've had a rapid shift in what the average human being is consuming. And the differences are most notable in Western civilized diets. Consequently, you've got more processed foods, a lot higher percentage of grain, a lot higher percentage of sodium additives, a lot less fiber, a lot less macronutrients. So it's a very bland, beige processed diet that the average Western diet is based on. If you look at that as the fundamental why we're seeing diseases of Western civilization, it really explains a lot. And so diseases of Western civilization are heart disease, diabetes, obesity, hypertension, psoriasis. So the terms Paleolithic diet, hunter-gatherer diet, ancient diet, all of these are the same principles. And you know, I have some patients who are very dogmatic about it, and I have some patients who are flexible about it. And I think there's probably a lot of flexibility as far as what that means. And, you know, the nuances are whether or not you should have dairy. Some people can probably have dairy in limited quantities, as long as it's full fat and has some of the milk proteins eliminated. Some people can probably have quinoa, which is not technically a grain. I mean, there's very nuanced ideas, but the bottom line is you need to be having foods that are as close to the way nature made them.
What is aggravating in milk? What does dairy do?
Right. So what happens with dairy is that it's one of the net acid producers. So it's involved with acidosis. The other problem is that a lot of individuals can't process through absence of lactase the lactose, so it's the milk protein. You're probably also getting a degree of shift in the gut bacteria. So through different mechanisms, through acidosis, through shifting of gut bacteria and inflammation of the lining, it's a very irritating substance. And I for example, tend to see much more problems in Asians with milk. It's just something that they tend to have more manifestations on their skin, whether it's eczema or acne.
And I've heard with acne that milk has shown to aggravate acne, but not other dairy products like cheese. Is there an explanation for that?
My theory is that it's non-fat milk. The average consumer is buying non-fat or skim milk, 1% or 2% milk. The average person is not usually consuming whole milk. When you're skimming the fat off of the diet, you're changing the structure and you're probably releasing more hormones. And it doesn't mean that the cow had to receive growth hormone. It's a lactating cow, so there's going to be hormones in the milk.
That's consistent with a Norwegian study that showed that acne was worth with more than 3 glasses of skim milk compared to higher fat content milk. So that's
interestingly, there's also data to support the introduction of skim dairy in women who are trying to conceive hinders their ability to become pregnant. And it's not an either or. Just by simply having a low-fat or non-fat dairy item included in your diet was associated with a statistically less likelihood of conceiving.
We hear also a lot about vitamin D.
So vitamin D is a very hot topic right now, and I'm starting to see the pendulum swing where people are starting to hear about vitamin D and then they sort of tune it out, sort of vitamin D overload. It's too much information, and people want to wait till the dust settles before recommendations are made. And that's the problem with this evolution of dietary recommendations. We've been creeping up year by year on our recommendations. The fact is, we probably don't know what the optimal amount is. When you look at vitamin D and its impact, I think the levels of 30 nanograms, which is what we're used to having as our cutoff of normal and not normal. So if they're 10 to 30, they're insufficient. If they're less than 10, they're deficient. When you get those patients that are in the deficient and insufficient category, that's when you're starting to see disease correlation. But the truth of the matter is we don't know what the optimal level is. So we know the floor, but we don't know the ceiling. And there have been studies supporting the use of vitamin D supplementation in other areas. So for example, a trial was done looking at pregnant women randomized to receive 400, 2,000, or 4,000 IU a day of D3. And they were looking at all pregnancy outcomes. And universally, those women who are on the 4,000 units a day had better outcomes as far as less preterm labor, less birth complications, better outcomes globally for baby and maternal health.
So what do you recommend to your patients?
For my acne patients, I really emphasize elimination of dairy. If they can only do one thing, make that the one thing that they eliminate. My second choice is then to eliminate gluten. Psoriasis patients are sort of the opposite. If I tell them if you can avoid one thing, try to eliminate gluten. But again, everything is sort of this paradigm shift, and I tell patients, pick the meal of the day that you're most likely to have one of those things you're not supposed to eat. Change it out and lean in the right direction. We know that our patients aren't going to be 100% compliant. We shouldn't expect that. So I just tell the patient, if you put 80% of the work in, you're going to get 80% of the benefit. As far as supplements are concerned, I have pretty much 3 big ones that I recommend. I recommend vitamin D3, anywhere from 4 to 5,000 units a day. I do check a vitamin D level before initiating, so sometimes I have to replace with a prescription. And then I do monitor it maybe about every 6 months. I recommend fish oil, omega-3 predominant, usually on the magnitude of about 2 grams a day. Some people I recommend more, some people maybe 1 gram if they can figure out a way to take it, because some patients don't like the fishy taste. So if they don't like the fishy taste or they don't agree with it, I will recommend krill oil. Krill is derived from a shrimp. They come in about 300 milligram tablets. Much smaller tablets, easier to take, and that doesn't have the fishy aftertaste. And then the last recommendation I make is for a probiotic. Probiotic is just good for gut health. I sometimes will ask patients, do they have any GI problems, GI symptoms? Definitely for all those patients with irritable bowel, fibromyalgia, all of these weird sort of atypical presenting things, I think need to have sort of the environment addressed.
Interesting. Well, this is, I think, very fascinating. I appreciate you sharing your knowledge. I think this is an area that's evolving and something that can really give some answers to our patients that they're looking for and fill a void of knowledge that we have.
I think so, too.
Physicians continue to see dietary concerns enter the exam room and are often asked to weigh in on the validity of claims made by the proponents of diets and supplements, and to help patients distinguish between the marketing claims made in the media and on supposed informational websites and actual benefits supported by scientific data. The challenge of being asked to evaluate and recommend products not regulated by the FDA is no small matter. New products are continually being introduced, and claims surrounding them can be difficult and time-consuming to sort through. NIH recommendations are a useful resource for physicians who may not have the time to review product-specific information and determine the efficacy of ingredients or the quality of the supplements themselves. They can also help distinguish between claims made by manufacturers and actual scientific evidence for the benefits of the supplementation. As pointed out by Dr. DeWitt, the benefits of some dietary supplements have been validated in reliable studies. For example, supplementation of EPA DHA omega-3 fatty acids, such as in fish oil, has been shown to be of benefit in prevention of heart disease, as an adjunctive therapy in inflammatory disorders, including some skin diseases, as well as for cognitive function and emotional health. The recommended daily dose of fish oil for most adults is 1 to 2 grams a day and can be taken in the form of oral supplements or by consuming at least 3.5 ounces of food sources high in omega-3 fatty acids, such as fish like salmon or mackerel. Dr. DeWitt also discussed the value of probiotic supplementation, which has been recommended in dietetic circles for decades and has recently come to be accepted in mainstream medical practice for prevention of antibiotic-related gastrointestinal complications. Research into the role of the microbiome in the modulation of certain diseases has also made the topic of probiotics relevant for multiple conditions from cystic fibrosis to mood disorders, and with respect to dermatology, the modulation of disease severity in atopic disorders, such as asthma and eczema, are being increasingly explored. It is important, however, to read the microbial profile of a given probiotic supplement before recommending or endorsing it. As among the many products that tout themselves as probiotics, only certain strains of beneficial bacteria have been studied with respect to the advertised benefits of probiotics. Thus, the NIH recommendations regarding the prescribing of probiotics for various conditions and for distinguishing between different brands and strengths can be a useful resource for clinicians and is available online. The question of vitamin D supplementation has also emerged as an issue of media attention and confusion, and useful guidelines from the American Academy of Dermatology and the NIH can be found online. These recommendations include that a person obtain vitamin D from dietary sources which are more reliable and safer than UV exposure, and good sources include fish, eggs, dairy products, fortified cereals, and vitamin D supplements, 600 to 800 international units per day for adults and 400 international units per day for children is recommended by the National Institutes of Health. Regarding dietary recommendations, an important principle of diet-based intervention remains that interventions must be personalized. One size does not fit all. For example, while the paleo diet may be beneficial for many, for some patients, for example with renal insufficiency, the emphasis on animal protein consumption may not be helpful, and in the case of pediatric or adolescent patients, it may not be advisable to limit their diet so rigidly as to eliminate all grains and legumes. To that end, Dr. DeWitt's recommendation to concentrate on limiting the one most impactful dietary factor may be the most feasible. For example, she mentioned that one may consider limiting gluten intake in the case of psoriasis, or eliminating dairy products to assist in the control of moderate to severe acne, and that some patients who suspect ingested causes of dermatitis may consider tailored elimination diets, for example, eliminating one variable at a time for certain periods to identify possible triggers. As with any medical recommendations we provide to our patients, in the realm of supplements and dietary modification, we must hold to the same principles of moderation, evidence-based practice, and the specific needs of each patient.